I would be going essentially to the east, and I would be going to that hangar that had all of those aircraft that are being refurbished. If I go in a little distance, make a left-hand turn to the north, then I'm going to the Orion Center. Do I keep going further to the north? Is that what you're saying, Eric? I mean, Mel, go ahead.
You're making a right angle off Bosch Avenue and
reflector 9-1.
No turn whatsoever.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the New England Reflector 912.
Channel 6.
They're useful, they're handy, they tell you a lot, but don't believe them out to four decimal places. Over.
Yeah, the particular person had had the computer program predict he should be putting in 12 picofarads, and as a impedance corrector across the incentive elements, and that didn't even come close. I think he had a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio after that, and his particular transceiver wouldn't tolerate it. Other than that, anything else you want to bring us up to date on, Eric? I mean, here we go. Kent, before I close down for the night. And in theory, we already have closed down. You got it, Kent. KQRIW.
Sweet dreams. The J5VKD is stepping free.
Bye-bye for now, Kent. We'll see you down the line. Was it Eric or someone else who wanted to make another comment? KQRIW.
Yeah, I tried making a comment during the net, but I got crushed a couple of times.
You know, we spend $1.5 billion for space shuttle flight. It is kind of expensive, you know. So it's really all about money, why they're taking it out of service. I mean, come on, we have aircraft that we keep going, but, you know, I mean, we do replace them. Because the cost involved in rebuilding it, you might as well just buy a new one, you know. But, by the way, you're going to the Symbol Technologies Amateur Radio Club event on Field Day?
I think I will. I've looked at the ARL site where it shows on Long Island where all of the field days are taking place. And I usually, if I've got any free time that weekend, will visit a number of them. And so, yes, I go to the one at Symbol. Are you tempting to go to that one, or which are the ones that you're going to be visiting? And, Joe, was it you that said you didn't get a chance tonight a couple of times you tried? KQRIW living?
Yeah, I just found something, for example. If you don't let the east repeat its bomb for at least 3 seconds, you officially cut him off from talking to you every single time. And even somebody on IRLP, if it's like less than a second and a half, I can't get in on IRLP. It just can't be done.
Okay, maybe Eric's got comments on all of the above.
Oh, he's absolutely right. You've got to leave the space. And then it's, you know, pot luck who gets it first. So. The server only allows one audio to pass at any given time, so you sometimes get confused because somebody will be talking on 8.5. But somebody grabbed the server first on 375, so you hear both people talking at the same time. But, yeah, that's just the reality.
I think what you're saying, Eric, is there is no solution for that. I guess we have to become a little bit more courteous on leaving spaces from time to time. Over to you.
Now, let's put it this way. You can dial into other nets and listen to stuff that goes on the IRLP. And for the most part, people are very, very well behaved and follow procedure. You know, that 2-second pause after the thing drops is like paramount. Otherwise, it'd be chaos.
Okay, so we're rude people. We're going to have to learn to become a little more courteous. Guess we got to work on that. KQRIW.
Yeah, well, one of these days, I mean, once I figure out what I'm doing with my life, I will actually get the uplink directly into the repeater, and then Kent won't have the problem of having to wait for the drop. What I could do, but then again, Rich would have to take care of it on his side to make the output PL go off, and that way the Echolink would be able to pick it up if he just uses the PL to code for telling it whether there's a carrier there or not.
Kent has a very desirable cell phone service, which gives him a zillion free minutes. If he dials his cell phone directly to some particular phone number that you suggested, would he be able to make any improvement on all of the above?
Unfortunately, I don't have any phone numbers that he could dial that he could talk into that would wind up in this audio path. So, it's a thought. It could be done, but I don't really see any reason for it. I mean, by the same token, Kent got a whole bunch of IRLP repeaters around him, whereas that I'm sure that folks wouldn't mind having some activity on it Sunday night, but that's up to him.
I'm having great trouble just handling the guys in New York, and we spent 4 hours. If we had New York to Dallas-Fort Worth, it might be beyond imagining. On top of that, if some of the Dallas-Fort Worth people heard some of the attitudes that the New York people have, I think they find it a little bit hard to take. We in New York think that whatever we do represents the whole United States. And from time to time, we get our comeuppance, we find out the rest of the world acts a little bit differently in certain areas.
Well, they're usually pretty good about communicating to other parts of the world and being respectful for the most part, but I get out of Dallas with lecture all the time, and you don't notice anything. I mean, people communicate the way you would expect them to communicate on amateur radio, you know. I mean, it's not like what you hear down the top 75, you know, bottom of 75 meters on a late Sunday night, but there's pretty good stuff that goes on. And the Dallas Reflector has usually got like 20 or 30 repeaters connected to it all over the world, so I know what you're saying, but I don't know how relevant it is.
Well, Ted one night did bring to our attention that we in New York think that lots and lots of jobs are being lost because everything is being outsourced when it comes to manufacturing. And he brought to our attention the fact that a number of the Dallas companies are discovering that they're coming back to insourcing, saving money and saving time. Let's see if Kent is still there, if he wants to say any words on that one. K2RIW.
I agree with him on that. Actually, there was a good piece done, I think it was tonight, about this company that makes windmills. They're using one of the shutdown auto manufacturing plants, which has everything they need in it, and they do it faster and cheaper.
Yeah, I saw that section where an automobile parts manufacturer in the Michigan area is now building these vertical windmills. My impression of those windmills is they're relatively small on area. I'm having trouble believing that they're going to generate a significant number of kilowatts. But that's just my opinion. Over to you, Eric.
It's called Windspire, if you want to look at it. At a 12-mile-an-hour wind, they generate 1.2 kilowatts.
Windspire, that's the brand name. What is the generic name for a vertical standing windmill as opposed to one that's got an axis that's parallel to the ground? That's a vertical. That's an axis that's perpendicular to the ground. There must be a name for that kind of windmill.
I don't know, but let Kent in here if he's going to be in there. Yeah, it sounds like he disappeared, yeah?
Looks like he did. We did, in theory, sign off with him earlier. Okay, I'm about to do the same thing. Another $100,000 well spent. Bye-bye, you all. Take your RIW.
All right, Dick, good night. We'll talk to you soon. K2RIW, K18X.
K2AJWHYY. Do you still have the frequency listed that you gave me, I think, a readout a couple of months ago and asked you about DTV? Do you still have that frequency offhand, what the offset is from the bottom end of the carrier?
What do you want to know? Oh, the one thing I will tell you now that the transition is over is that all the DTV signals will now exactly line up. No more funny offsets on anything.
Yeah, it's like 0.3094. I thought it was 4.1 something change. I had the rest of it written down, but I don't have specifically what the how many digits it was. But it's funny you should mention that, because what I'm noticing on the low band channels, like channel 5 and 6, there are definitely two different DTV transmitters I'm hearing on each channel, because I can hear the difference between the two signals. If I go to that frequency, I can actually hear a distinctive 5, 6, 7 hertz beat between two different carriers, and it comes and goes throughout the day. So I am noticing that they're not all exactly in the same precise frequency.
Now, what are you saying about the BHS as far as frequency goes?
Well, first of all, is this .309, was it like 441, I remember? I thought you had told me at one time it was like 0.309, 441 is the frequency. I don't know, I think it was a couple more digits after that.
Yeah, I don't remember what day it was. We're talking about the pilot. That's part of my book, I'll just tell you. It's not this mess. I don't think I ain't playing it. Oh, well. But yeah, they should be spot on at this point.
Okay. What I've noticed on a couple of these channels already, I'm hearing, I can hear on my R7000 if I go to that particular carrier frequency on a particular RF channel. I'll give you an example, RF channel 5, RF channel 6. There are different times of the day I can specifically hear the frequency beating with something else. Sometimes you hear one frequency, sometimes you can hear something up coming alongside it that's about 5, 6, 7 hertz off of frequency. And I remember you saying on one of these tech nets that not that frequency is not exactly on that frequency. It's off like about 5 or 10 hertz, something like that, or plus or minus 5 hertz. So I'm apparently hearing the difference, and it enables me to actually see that there's other DTV signals out there. I've also noticed from some of the UHF channels also, there are multiple channels on a particular RF channel that I may be able to receive with an omni antenna.
You know, on the RF portion of this signal, there aren't any multiple channels. It's just one channel, you know. There's only one channel 21. There's only one channel 33. Even though there might be, you know, six or seven different programs in it. But that doesn't have any effect on the RF part of it.
I fully understand that, Eric. You're completely missing what I'm telling you. I am hearing another RF carrier on the same frequency that comes and goes throughout the day on some of these UHF channels. If I tune to a particular RF channel, like some of the UHF channels, like, say, channel 30, for example, which is now used by when a Spanish channel, I think 68, moved down to channel 30, I can sometimes hear something else, I don't know if it's out of Connecticut or something else, on the same frequency. But it's not the exact same frequency, that's what I'm talking about. There's co-channel transmissions on some of these channels. I've noticed them especially on channel RF channel 5 and RF channel 6.
Oh, so you're hearing other stations on the same frequency, or are you seeing them?
Can't see them because the decoder won't lock up. The antenna I have is not good enough for channel 5 and 6, it doesn't have the elements that aren't long enough. It's only channel 7 to 13 antenna, but my decoder doesn't even see the DTV signal there. I'm just saying that I am hearing on my R7000 with a monitor antenna that there is something on that frequency. Sometimes there's two stations I can hear because the carriers are not exactly the same frequency. So maybe like they sound like they're about 5, 6 hertz off from each other.
And you're listening to what, a narrow bandwidth around the pilot?
That is correct, with the receiver put in the FM narrow mode.
Yeah, I got you. I mean, I've been doing some DXing, you know, the receiver will have it. Well, it doesn't need to know anything about locking up. It's very rudimentary, and it just, you tune it to a channel, and it just decodes whatever's doesn't care. So, but there's been nights where the band's been very open.
You're definitely correct in that, because I did see a channel 22, which is a WNJS occupying RF channel 22. That must have been possibly one of the ones that was giving you the business. You occupied that channel. If you're one particular band, it was a good band opening.
Yeah, what's occupying 22 now?
I have decoded WNJS. I've got that channel, which is DT23, but it's on RF channel 22. WNJS.
You know where they're located?
I haven't looked them up on the map. Probably is New Jersey, Southern New Jersey station or something like that. I know there's also another channel, RF channel 22, coming from Richmond, Virginia, which may have been the one that was clobbering you in a particular day. I told you, like, about 3 weeks ago or so. That was giving the business of knocking out channel 22 from Plainview.
Yeah, because now there is no more there is no more 22 as far as Plainview goes.
No, that's why I'm able to decode this channel and see channel 22, because you were taking it out before, and worst case, when I was there before, it wouldn't, I wouldn't decode either one. It wouldn't actually knock your channel out. I couldn't see anything. Couldn't see you, couldn't see you at the station. Now that you don't occupy that actual RF carrier channel anymore, I have gotten channel 20 on RF 22, I've gotten WNJS. Can you tell me that station's off the air?
Yeah, where are you located?
Sayville. So I'm like 46 miles from Midtown Manhattan, approximately 46, 47 miles.
No, because NJS is in Camden. It's part of NJN. It's the New Jersey network station. But that's quite a good throw, but you're getting it over the water, I bet.
Oh, sure I am, because I've got a bunch of channels that are coming in over the water. RF channel 16 has got WHRR, which is Hampton Roads, Virginia. RRN, I'm not sure where they are. I've got a couple of DC channels, Baltimore DC channels running on digital, that decoded digitally with a band open stuff. So yeah, it is partially a water path.
So what are you using for a receiver to actually see this stuff? Well, you look it out and spectrum analyze it, get the antenna pointed right, and then use the receiver.
Well, the spectrum analyzer was only to look at the waveform. I'm actually seeing this stuff on the air with my Insignia decoder. I have two of them. Same thing as the Zenith box, and it works actually pretty good. I can actually leave that channel decoder sitting on a particular channel and give me no signal until it detects the signal. And if something's there, it will come in. I did that when channel 7 went off the air. Went off analog, and I watched the other room come on the air on digital. I didn't even have to scan to find the channel. It just popped right on the up on the decoder, and there it was. So it's a pretty nice little decoder. But that's what I'm using. I have two of them. They work pretty good.
What model?
Oh, let me look at the box. It's the same thing as the Zenith DT901. And the box says NS-DXA1-APT. That's the model number of the Insignia, and these come out of Best Buy.
Yeah, I got you. Okay. I know what you're using. So you'll find that this digital DX thing will be very interesting, because the way that the RF is made and the way it's decoded, you don't realize that there's actually error correction on the RF. There's something called TARF encoding. And each one of those 8 VSB carriers actually has 3 trellis symbols, so there's a lot of error correction that goes on to begin with, and of course the thing is randomized and shuffled like that. It makes it less affected by some of the things in the atmosphere. So even polarization shifts is not a big deal with that.
Okay, well, it's a close pretty good. Your channel up on RF channel 13 is pretty good. I got about 85 to 90% reading on that now compared to couldn't see it at all on channel 61. So you're pretty much right up there with channel 7 and 11 as far as signal strength. They're a little stronger than you typically, but not by very much.
Yeah, well, what's the difference between 28 and 33?
Let's see. 28 is about 70, 75. That's 75% approximately the same. And see, 33. Let's see what that one is. Okay, channel 2. That one I think is a little slightly less than CBS. I actually get CBS stronger than I get channel 28. It's actually stronger. It's about right on, underneath the good, the G for good on the signal strength. And channel 4 is a little less than that. So as I say, it's about 85% on channel 2 and about 75% for signal strength on channel 4 for RF channel 28. So I don't get channel 4 as strong as RF channel 33. It's a little bit different. But also, I don't have a rotor, so I can't rotate the antenna to take out the slight discrepancies from moving trees and things like that. That might be giving me a little bit of difference.
That's interesting. Well, as you go, knowing which channel's on what antenna on Empire, it tells you a bunch of stuff. How do you get 44 compared to the other guys?
44 is between the G and the O on the signal strength. That was always consistently, I'd say, rated at about 90%, almost all the time. And it was typically much better than 45, which is about typically 65 to 70% when they were running on channel 45, channel 7. So 44 was always good coming out. Now, even with bad weather, it was still up on the high end of the scale as far as signal strength.
Well, the reason for that is 44 is coming off an entirely different antenna system that's set up properly. So, but they're on different parts of the building, so it used to be that you had to move your antenna just like a degree to make 44 good or 45 good. So, you know, by the time the new year comes around, I think the new antenna system will be in place and some of those problems will go away.
Now, are they looking to put a master UHF antenna system on the building with as omnidirectional pattern as possible? Is that what the game plan is?
Okay, currently, right now, there's three different UHF antenna systems. One UHF antenna system, which is just below the 102 observation. Now, let's start with the one that's on the mast. The one that's on the mast, count 25. By the way, the channel 25 that you're getting digital is not from Empire anymore. It's from the 4 Times Square. So that's one antenna system. There's another antenna system which is below the 102nd floor. That's first of all, is on the left side, looking at it from Long Island. The one on the left side is Fox, which is actually a little bit lower, which is channel 44. The one on the right side is one half of the main radiator for channel 33, 38, so that's CBS, NBC, WWOR, and that's it. That's all that's coming off that antenna now. That gets to be loaded with everybody. And that antenna has a backfill antenna, which is runs between the 81st floor and the 84th floor that looks south towards Brooklyn, and that messes everything up.
Okay. Now, is Channel 9 sorry they didn't go back to VHF with the signal strength coverage they have up here currently compared to the VHF? Because there is a noticeable difference between their signal strength on Channel 38 and so like Channel 7, 11, or 13. They're definitely lower than you guys.
All right, you got to remember this. The Channel 9 is owned by the same people that own Channel 5. And when the time came to make the decision about whether you wanted to stay or go back to your original branding, somebody chose to stay. So they stayed.
Okay. So it has nothing to do with the coach challenge appearance of somebody else out there like 90, 125 miles away or something like that. They just want to stay up with UHF and that's that.
Right. You actually had the choice. It was last year and a half ago, I think it was, where you got to decide whether you wanted to go where your analog was and maintain the branding, or stay where you were if you were inside core, or choose a place inside the core for the final transition.
Okay. Well, I hope they're happy with their choice, then.
Yeah, well, anybody that was on low VHF, like Channel 2, they knew that being there is not a good thing. Channel 4 is also not quite a good thing, but not as bad as Channel 2. Channel 5 and 6 are actually okay in a lot of the other areas of the country. And, 7 through 13 is a definite plus. You get 13 with some really nice numbers, don't you?
Oh, yeah, I said it. That's right up there with Channel 7 and 11. They're slightly stronger in signal strength, but not by very much at all. Channel 13 is right up there, maybe within a couple of percent as far as the signal strength unit. So, it's, yeah, definitely it's getting out.
Now, that's 2.4 kilowatts of transmitter that goes through a heck of a lot of power to the antenna.
Okay, well, it's making it from point A to point B, which is good out here. I guess you don't have so many complaints with people with the outside antennas now, but, you know, some of the UHF channels are a little lacking out here, especially I noticed that with like a heavy rain type of thing. They do take a drop in the signal strength.
What, in your opinion, Eric, is the major disadvantage of Channel 2 RF? Is that impulse noise interference, impulse noise vulnerability?
You know, all you gotta do is listen to 6 meters, Dick. Yeah, it's impulse noise kills it.
I can't seem to think that the COFDM being used in Europe gets killed a lot faster with impulse noise than 8VFV.
He's saying it falls apart faster or it holds up better?
He says COFDM falls apart a lot faster. He says one noisy spark plug on a motorcycle going down the street in the United Kingdom can wipe out all the UHF television in the area.
Oh, I think that's a bit of an exaggeration. But he's mostly right. But, you know, it's a different animal. You don't have the multipath problem.
I guess two suffers from sporadic E-openings in May and June, so that's to be avoided. By the time you get up to 4, 5, and 6, I guess you're saying there are a number of places in the country where you're using it. Kent thought that there is going to be a Channel 2 digital television from Cedar Hill in the Dallas area.
Hey, I didn't say it didn't work. It decided it's a problem. You know, one of the things that they're beginning to discover is that if you do actually generate some more output, you can overcome some of those issues.
And I guess it's a lot easier to develop more output at the lower frequencies. Is that sort of true?
Now, the frequency part is irrelevant. Really, truly. I mean, you know, I can generate 60 kilowatts at 500 megahertz just as easily as I can generate, you know, 60 kilowatts at 54 megahertz. Although it would be in a different form. But, actually, my Channel 13 transmitter, which is IVHF, that produces that full tilt. Now we're talking analogs here in terms of these numbers, and then I'll tell you what the digital numbers are. I can generate 30 kilowatts from that transmitter. It's all solid state, and the I got two of them, so I can make 60 kilowatts if I need to. But that's analog. That 30 kilowatts of analog now becomes, I don't remember exactly what the right number is, something like somewhere between 10 and 12 or something of that nature.
Now, it generates 10 or 12 because it's an entirely new transmitter and it's solid state, or the original 30 kilowatt capable transmitter to have sufficient linearity for the digital service must be backed off to 10 or 12 kilowatts. Which are you saying, Eric?
Now, if you remember a couple months back, we had this discussion. I had my book in front of me, too. The problem is the way we go and measure stuff, all right? Because now I'm using not small segments of the 6 megahertz space. I've got energy in the entire 6 megahertz of space, okay? The transmitter is only going to draw so many amps, period, based on the gain of such and such. I don't want to go through this again, but, yeah. Now my mind is like, there was a simple explanation, and now I've lost it.
Well, let me make some guesses. During a horizontal sync pulse, blacker than black signal, I'm guessing your channel 13 transmitter in New York City has got 30 kilowatts peak envelope power capability. The digital television is smearing its power across all 6 megacycles. The average power I would see into a true RMS watt meter, I think it's saying, is 10 or 12 kilowatts. And by the way, the 30 kilowatt peak envelope power of the analog, my guess is the average of that is something like 10 kilowatts. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's the right neighborhood. If I make my 60 kilowatts, when I'm thinking, it's the way the transmitter manufacturers label things. I can generate 60 kilowatts of 5 kilohertz in one frequency. If I was generating that with a sweep generator and I opened it up across the whole 6 megahertz, that's the equivalent of what we're talking about in terms of being able to make that level of energy across the whole bandwidth.
Now, the 6 meg digital channel, which on a simple spectrum analyzer looks like a Martin's head display of a whole lot of noise. It's got a whole lot of individual frequencies in there, all running simultaneously. The average of that is 10 or 12 kilowatts, but the peak envelope power in there at any one instant might come close to 30 kilowatts, but it's only there for a nanosecond. Go ahead.
I believe that's right. That's the road we were going down. The reality is that you can only generate so much energy with a certain amount of input power. But getting beyond that, if I were to do the thermodynamic measurement of power dissipated between the digital and the analog, I bet you it'd be exactly 100% the same.
I agree with you. So a true RMS watt meter connected to an analog transmitter, during the time you're transmitting an average picture, by that I mean there's a real big difference in power output when you're transmitting a black picture versus a white picture. So if I transmit an average picture in analog and then go to digital, I suspect the true RMS watt meter is going to read very close to the same. If I have a 1 nanosecond time constant peak envelope power sensing meter, again, I think they would be very close to the same. K2LIW.
Yeah, K2RIW, K2J. Now I'm thinking about it. There's a magic number that we would multiply the peak reading watt meter to get the actual average power because it takes into consideration the sync pulses. I think you multiply the number by, it was like a 5 or 6 digit number. It was 0.60 something, 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 something. And from that, you got your the real true RMS power that the analog transmitter was making on average, because, it all depends upon picture content. Whereas with the digital transmitter, that's all. The reason why you've got that nice flat thing there is because there's these random number generators generating random numbers, which in essence makes sure that all levels are being generated all at the same time.
Does it have a little bit of a gray code characteristic, if you know what that means, Eric? Visually speaking, if I set up a shaft encoder and I was dumb enough to set it up as a pure binary counter, somewhere in the shaft, all of my bits are changing simultaneously. If I set up a gray code, I'm never changing more than one bit for any one degree of rotation, so to speak. Does the 8BSB do something similar? In other words, all the bits never change all at once. K2RIW?
K2RIW, K2J. Well, it is a synchronous form of encoding, the trellis, actually, each symbol is equivalent to 3 bits. The trellis is always rotating in a very specific pattern, but the data itself is shuffled, so it's random. So it always appears that you are generating the maximum output. It always appears that you're making FFFFFFFF when you look at it in the end. But it's also randomized, and that's why each symbol being, was it 92 nanoseconds? Across the line, when you're looking at that across 6 megahertz, it just looks like one nice flat output of noise.
Yeah, I'm getting the impression that each transmitter, analog or digital, is putting out very close to the same QRMS power. The major difference is the reference that's used for rating it. An analog transmitter is rated for peak envelope power during sync trip. And no one even mentions the average RMS power. Whereas with the digital transmitter, we do tend to measure QRMS power. Is that true?
That's absolutely correct. And actually, I have a HP power meter that I use to measure the true RMS power, and it reads accurately. But yeah, what we call 30 kilowatts is really peak envelope power. It's a lot of transistors, I'll tell you. Actually, that transmitter uses MRF151G, which is 2 power sets in the package. Uses 2 of them, and that pair generates 600 watts. And then there's... No, each pair is 300 watts, sorry. There's a DPGH transistor, 150. So 300 watts, and they're put together in pairs, which are then paired to another set of Wilkinson couplers. And let's see, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, it's a long since I've looked at it. There's a lot of boards. But each board will generate about, right, there's 30 boards. Each board generates about 1,500 watts.
Do you have to change the boards as assemblies, or you change the transistor itself if the transistor goes bad?
Well, generally, in a transmitter like that, you can yank a board out and, you barely notice if there's any difference in the output. But you usually keep a spare board, pop the board in. But replacing the transistors and getting the bypass caps exactly in the right place is fun. You need a good sweep generator and a detector at the end, and a power supply to run it and stuff it through there. Once you change the transistors and set up the bias, then there's these little caps that run along the microstrip, and you have to find the right spot for them.
Okay, that's called snowflaking. 1,500 watts per printed circuit board, and 30 printed circuit boards implies 45 kilowatts capable, but you never go above 30 to get linearity. Is that roughly true?
Yeah, that's roughly true. Actually, it's less than 30 because four of them were for the sound carrier, which is independent from the video carrier.
Okay, 4 equals sound. Interesting stuff. That transmitter fills up two great big rack panels.
No, actually, if you can think of it as three racks butted up together, the center rack being the modulator, the power supply, the big power transformer, three-phase power transformer, and the monitoring gear. The cabinet on the left, the cabinet on the right, each cabinet worth about 15 kilowatts.
The three-phase power transformer. Is the rear voltage into that 480 three-phase?
No, if you're talking Con Ed, it's 408.
408 three-phase. I'm going to guess that that's a delta, or is that a Y?
It's delta. Actually, it's more like delta Y, but it's delta.
Delta with some kind of a center tap ground?
Yeah, well, you have your option to float it or not, but it's usually ground.
And in theory, if you've got the transformers wired with delta and Y and full-wave rectification on each, you almost don't need a filter capacitor. What comes out is so smooth.
Now, let's put it this way. It all regulated. So it goes into a junky, huge, frickin' bridge rectifiers, and then there's a bank of about 50 in each cabinet. Each cabinet has, I think 25, if I remember correctly, it's been a long time, but I think there are 180,000 microfarad capacitors. They're all hooked together with this big, fat, metal bus bar, and there's two packages in them because it's plus and minus 50 volts, is what I think.
Plus and minus 50? The transistors take 50. What's taking minus 50?
No, it's plus. It's 50 volts. Not minus, sorry. There's just two sets of them in each cabinet, right? One for the upper bank and one for the lower bank. So that way you can lose the power supply and still be on the air.
Very nice. That transmitter has existed how long and what kind of reliability? Has it ever had any hiccups?
Well, this particular transmitter is built by a company called Locan, which is in a little town south of Toronto. The transmitter, believe it or not, was designed in 1978-79. And it's like one of the most solid transmitters out there.
Larkan, L-A-R-K-A-N?
L-A-R-C-A-N.
1979. You're saying those particular transistors, MRF-151Gs, they existed in 1979?
Yeah, I believe that's when they first came out. In that neighborhood. But the latest design of the transistor was like 1982 or 83. And you look at, I'll show you the books one day. I mean, you look at the ICs that they kept using in the modulator and stuff like that, and you know that they've been around for a while.
Are many broadcast centers using that exact brand of transmitter? Is it a popular one because it's so reliable?
As a matter of fact, it is. It's a smaller brand than, say, Harris or Thompson, or what was known as Comarp, which was actually transmitter manufacturer, funny. What started out as RCA became Kodak at the Comarc. From Comarc it became Tomcast. From Tomcast it became Grass Valley. From Grass Valley it became Thompson.
Wow. Was all of that mergers and acquisitions?
Yeah, that's correct. The Thompson CFF, which is a French company, which is actually the company that owns it now. There was a division of that company within another company that was called Tomcast. Grass Valley was a company started in Grass Valley, California, which was bought up by Thompson, and they consolidated Phillips, Grass Valley, and a couple of other things together to make create one company. There used to be in the broadcasting industry, there was Ampex, there was RCA, there was Utah Scientific, there was Philips, there was a company called Bosch, I was, Cal Noelco was Philips, there was another company called Pi, and eventually it all became one company. I wonder if there were any credit default swaps along the way. No, actually, Sony started going the way of Ampex. Ampex was Ampex actually still exists. They make military data recorders. But when you get so big and you supply everything, and you're talking about limited demand market here, you can really get yourself into big trouble.
Didn't Ampex at one time live in Syosset, where they were making vacuum tubes and pouring toxic chemicals into the local soil?
Well, you're thinking of a division of Philips that is called Amperex.
Different company. Okay. North American Philips was one of the other?
Yeah, well, North American Philips was the holder of the brand name Norelco. If you remember for a while, there were Norelco PC-60s and 70s, which were like the workhorse of the broadcast industry. They were the first 30-millimeter Plenicon cameras that were pretty much all solid state.
You ever hear the name Vladimir Zworkin?
Yes, he lived to be 102. We actually did an interview with him when he was 101 down at his estate in Florida, where you couldn't find the gate because the gate was edged.
Wow. And I think he worked to 102 and died at 103 or something like that?
Yeah, well, I think he lived his life for ICA, you know.
All of that was for David Sarnoff. And when did, how long did David Sarnoff live?
Didn't he die in the early 60s?
I'll take your word for it. And Philo T. Farnsworth, I think he lasted close to 2000, didn't he?
No, I don't think he made it that long. I think his wife did eventually get a ruling in his favor because Sarnoff just masticated him.
Yeah, I saw the play on that subject. I'm having trouble remembering the name of the play now. It was in New York City a couple of years ago. The Farnsworth Experiment, I think it was. Yeah, I think it was called the Farnsworth Experiment. Something along those lines.
Yeah, no, I know what you're talking about. I should know the name of it. I just don't remember at this point. But, yeah, most people aren't aware that Dworkin was actually one of the co-creators of the video disc. Well, actually, what was the predecessor to the laser disc, which is the RCA capacitive discharge video disc. Is there somebody else there?
Answer that minute.
Yes.
Oh, sorry to barge in, so I was just driving home from work. And you tried to get me a segment, but it didn't work. I heard you guys talking about advertising. I wonder if I can ask you guys, gentlemen, a couple of questions about Motorola.
His audio is really low, Dick. Did you hear what he said?
I know he said he's got some questions to ask, but he's going to have to give us a lot more audio if we're going to hear him.
Is that any better?
Quite a bit better. Why don't you repeat your question?
Okay, thanks. I just heard you guys talk about Motorola transistors and amplifiers a little while ago. I was wondering if I can throw some questions at you guys. You sound like the right person for that. I have a Motorola for communication concept that I bought as a kid, a 300 watt amplifier, and I have a question about the bias and stuff for the transistor. My name is Robert.
I guess you can try your question, Robert.
Okay, basically what happened was I got from communication concept HF amplifier, supposed to be 300 watts. Uses a pair of MRF 429, 150 watts each. And I managed to blow one of them up.
So I have two questions. One, can I just replace one because they came in mass pairs? And question number two, the reason I blew it up is I think that my bias voltage was all amperage, rather, was all messed up. What's an easier way to do to set the bias voltage without blowing the transistors up?
You want me to answer that, or you want to do it, Dick?
Why don't you fire away, Eric?
All right. First of all, if you're fiddling with bias voltage, you better not be putting any drive into it. All right? Because if you're putting drive into it, you're going to fry them. If they're match set, if they're in parallel, I change them into pair. You don't have to, but if you want to save yourself a lot of pain, you would. You make sure that the bias circuit is working before you do anything. It's a constant current source circuit, and usually has a knob on it. And depending upon who designed it, you find that the idle current's going to be anywhere from like 50 mils to, a half an amp, depending upon what configuration it's in. And if you're uncertain that the bias circuit's working properly, pop the other transistor out, power it up, check out the bias circuit. It's working right, travels up and down. You take maybe a 50-100 ohm resistor across it, put some load on it, and make sure it doesn't go anywhere. Then get it off, put the transistors in it. Do a good job of soldering it in. Set the bias to what it's supposed to be without any drive going into it. And once you get the idle current right, you shouldn't have any problems if you've got a proper termination for the whole thing.
Okay, that's what I did originally, but it was weird because the BIOS transistor they gave me, it was good, but their instructions are not all that great, and I measured the transistor out, and I got a different. I also looked up the data sheet for the BIOS transistor, and it gave a different pinout from what they were telling me. So I think I put them backwards though. It was what they were telling me and not what the data sheet said. So that's probably why. But the interesting thing was that I was still able to adjust the bias voltage, even though the transistor seemed like it was backwards. In other words, I turned them 180 degrees around. And I think that's what did it. Now, once I put the transistors in, I guess to measure the current just right off the regular source, the input voltage.
No, well, if you put the transistors back, we'd get a bias voltage would probably go up and down because of the way it would be set up. But that's why they're talking about putting a load on it, making sure that it stays put. Because with the transistor in there backwards, it would probably have just gone away with any kind of a decent load on it. Because when you're measuring it with a meter, your meter is probably several hundred mega ohms. There's several hundred thousand ohms or mega ohms that can offer no load to the bias circuit there. So do that, make sure that's right before you put the finals in. And as far as where you measure the current, again, depends upon where, how it was made. Generally, there's the emitter resistors. Let's see, you said it was a 427. 420, I don't even remember where that bipolar set. I have to look it up. But if you have the service information on an amplifier, they will tell you where to measure the bias, and it will probably be a small voltage, or they'll be either coming off the drain or the emitter, depending on whether it's a FET or a bipolar. There'll be a voltage drop between two points, and that's where you'll be set. That'll be the measuring point to set your bias up with.
Yeah, the MRF-429 is the bipolar, and interestingly enough, as somebody else mentioned about the emitter resistor, there is none. It goes straight to ground. And the other thing is the only instructions I got is the Motorola application note that came with it. It's basically whoever designed it. It's got the name of the guy. It's an old design. Two transistors, one transformer, and one input transformer, a couple of other resistors, and that's it, and the bias circuit. So it's a fairly simple circuit, and I just think the bias voltage is messed up, current rather than that. You're right, you probably wouldn't want to turn something down because of the transistor being the other way around. But no, there's no emitter resistor on this thing. It goes straight to ground.
Now, this sounds like a Herbal Granger amplifier.
Actually, you know which application note it was? You could have the book somewhere.
I can say it's 106, AN106 if I'm right, but I could be wrong. Communication Concepts has it on their website. 706, something with the 06. Either 106 or 706. I can't really recall it right now. I'm actually in the car. But it's right off of Communication Concepts on the website. They actually give you the application note there. I don't know if you have access to the computer right now, but and it's the MRF-429 300 watt HF amplifier. They have two versions of it. I got the one that has the 50 volt board instead of the 13A.
Yeah, hang on a second. I'll be right back. I think I know what you're talking about. It's the one that's got those Amidon ferrite cores for the transformer.
Yeah, that's the other thing, the final transformer, the output transformer. They don't tell you anything how to make it. They just give you a mini coax wire and a round ferrite core. And you're supposed to wind it around there and then crisscross them at one end, but they're really not giving you any clear indication of how to wire it, how to do it. I know you got a problem. I don't know if that's a big issue. I mean, I was putting out 200 watts, but then it ended up, or 300 watts, but it ended up blowing out. Actually, it was only putting out about 200, and then it ended up finally blowing out one of the transistors. It was pretty hot, both of them. While I was trying it, it was getting really hot real quick. I'm talking about in like 3-4 seconds it was burning. So, I don't know.
Any thoughts, Chick? KJRW, you still there? Well, I guess Dick Wren. Yeah, I'm looking through it. See if I can find it. Did you say it was MRF-429?
Yeah, that's correct. MRF-429, and I believe it is application note 706. And apologies for Dick, I didn't use the tape already. I just figured I would you guys to sound like to know what you were talking about.
Stand by a minute.
Yeah, take your time. I appreciate your help.
Does it use a 723 for the bias regulator?
Yeah, that's the one around me.
Alright, here's what you can do. When you get a warping, right, with no drive in it, hook it up, put an ammeter on the power input, and adjust it for about 300 mils with nothing going into it.
Okay, and that's with the transistors in it, obviously, so it's up to 300 milliamps. That sounds about right to what they said, 300 milliamps. I just wasn't sure where it was.
Yeah. You're only talking two transistors on this amplifier plus the bias circuitry, right?
Yeah, that's correct. The application note actually is for 600 watts, but they're only using, I guess, the drive portion of it to get the 300 watts.
No, the only thing I see in the book is for the two-stage kilowatt. You know, each one of these boards is 300 watts, and you put four of them together. There is no AN706. That was AN749. That's the device control. It's just 758 rather. There it is. So, whatever. But that's the value that you of bias you want to do for those two transistors together. And you're right, they go straight to ground. So, you would actually have to measure from the tab
to the center point. Let's see, how's the key people would know that?